That is the scale and the scope of God's plan. That's the size of his purpose. He is on about the redemption of nothing less than everything. That prayer is for everyone. You can be seen that video whether they know it or not. And this is always what God has been on about. As we saw last week, he has been a God of deliverance since the very moment that our first parents first sinned. And it's something a lot of people don't see. It's really one of the great tragedies of Western civilization that has been so widely lost, that there's this popular idea that the God of the Old Testament is all about fire and brimstone and judgment and wrath. Well, Jesus in the New Testament give us a God who's all about love and mercy and forgiveness. And that, to be blunt, is a lie from the pit of hell. Right from the start, God has been on about redemption and deliverance for those who are enslaved by sin and oppressed by death. And yes, his wrath is a real thing. It's the wrath of the lover against anyone and anything that hurts the beloved. His wrath is against sin and against death. And in those times when we cling to our sin kicking and screaming, essentially we're getting in the way. And so his wrath falls on us as a consequence. But if we're willing to let him work, then it becomes instead the scalpel of the surgeon to cut us free from the power and the penalty of sin and death. God is in the deliverance business. All in. Full stop. Now, because we are human, we can take anything too far or take it the wrong way. There's a danger to any truth we might say. You know, and in this, the danger is that we fall into the error of the Jews. You know, the error against which Jesus worked, one of them against which he worked, which is collapsing that hour to mean a very small us. Yeah, the Jews in the centuries leading up to the coming of Christ affirmed God as the Lord of all creation and the maker of all things, but they believed in him as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob only. They effectively reduced him to just one more of the gods of the nations, with his own particular nation to care about and be concerned about. They believed God was basically in it just for them. And that has to have taken some work, actually, to have managed to misplace God's words to Abraham. Because what was God's promise? It was that the end game of what God was doing through Abraham wasn't just going to be personal blessing. It wasn't just going to be family blessing. The end game of what God was doing was going to be to bless the entire world. But they lost sight of that. They collapsed it back down to themselves. And it's all too easy for us to do the same. How many times have you heard, God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life? Well, really, God has a wonderful plan for the world. And because he loves you, he's invited you to join in and to play a part in it, which may or may not feel wonderful. And in point of fact, is absolutely guaranteed to give you times when your life feels the exact backwards of wonderful. The scale of God's plan of deliverance and redemption goes far beyond our idea of a wonderful life. God is not Frank Capra. What he's doing is vast beyond our ability to comprehend. And having said that, we then hit the second point of difficulty in this story, because his approach to do it, to doing this, is so counterintuitive as to seem to us downright bizarre. I mean, human beings know how to do large-scale deliverance efforts. I mean, at least we think we do. We've tried a number of them throughout history, with names like the United Nations and the Soviet Union. I mean, obviously, our record is not the best, but I mean, it's like W.C. Fields said, you know, quitting smoking is easy. I've done it 6 times. So what exactly is the issue? Well, the missionary and theologian Leslie Newbegin, I think, put his finger on the problem, on why such efforts never turn out the way that we hope. When human beings try to work deliverance and redemption on a grand scale, we begin with justice, which we try to define by law and enforce by power. And in so doing, we create structures which are easily hijacked by all the most unscrupulous and unjust among us. Whereas, remarkably, the one who is the source and definition of all true justice began not with justice, but with mercy. Not with demand, but with gift. I think Dick mentioning Bryan Stevenson's book was extremely apt this morning. I was very grateful for that, because just mercy really captures it. Instead of working from the top down to impose redemption on a recalcitrant world, God worked from the bottom up. He chose an ordinary individual to be the vessel for his plan. And actually, and this is a bit speculative, but I do think it sort of illustrates what he knowingly got himself in for, working with human beings in the first place. I suspect he actually chose two. Because, I mean, we're not told. Genesis doesn't say. But why else did Terah pack up his family and leave Ur for Canaan? I think God called Terah first. And Terah, for whatever reason, decided partway along that it really wasn't worth the trouble. And so he settled down, and he founded a little city, and he named it after his dead son. And he said that was enough. And then Terah dies, and God comes to Abram and says, essentially, okay, let's try this again, shall we? And you can imagine how this might have looked to Abram. I mean, on the one hand, obviously, he's partway there. It's a shorter trip from Haran than it is from Ur. But on the other, this is an adventure that has already been abandoned once. And how eager are people usually to pick up those sorts of things and go back to them? And yet that's, I think, what God calls Abram to do. And he says yes. And God's plan goes forward on the promise that an older couple who've never been able to have children, who are wandering around as resident aliens in a foreign land, will have a son whose children and grandchildren will multiply into a great nation that will possess that land. As plans for world salvation go, This one's about like trying to pour Lake Michigan through a McDonald's drinking straw. But this is what God does. Why? Well, I think there's two reasons. And one is, you might call it practical psychology. It's so ludicrous that if it works, it has to be God. No human being would ever take credit for thinking this one up. Anyone who ever tried to write it as a novel would be rejected by publishers on the grounds that it was simply too far-fetched to be plausible. And no human being ever could take credit for making it succeed. And Abram, being right in the middle of it, has to live in absolute dependence on God. Some centuries later, God tells his prophet Habakkuk, "The righteous shall live by faith." A few centuries after that, Paul picks it up, writing to the Romans, and makes it effectively the theme verse of that book. Abram discovers this reality long before either of these guys come around, because he has to live by faith. He doesn't have anything else. You know, I mean, he is so far out on a limb, never mind sawing the thing off, it's not supporting his weight at all. You know, if God doesn't hold him up, he's Wile E. Coyote chasing the Roadrunner out into the middle of the canyon. He had to live by faith. It's the only option God gave him. Now, you might, I suppose, call that the cynical reason. But there's another one as well, and I think it's the more important one. God chooses to redeem the world through relationship. He doesn't do it through programs and structures and laws. Those are secondary. They come because where two or three are gathered together, somebody has to write the bylaws. But they're not the point. They're simply the things that sort of accumulate around because as human beings, that's how we work. He does it personally. He works the same way in delivering the world as he did in creating it. One person at a time. And in keeping with this, he doesn't use law and rules as his instrument. He doesn't try to order people to behave and leave that to do the job for him. He uses promise. And specifically, he makes a covenant with Abram. And this is one of those really loaded biblical words that's not so current, you know, in our culture. You know, it's easy for us to collapse it to a simple agreement, but it's far more than that. Or perhaps think of it as a contract, but that doesn't really do it either. We're familiar with agreements, we're familiar with contracts. You might define a contract, you know, as an agreement that has enforceable penalties, which is held by the government. But the thing is, contracts are 50-50. If one side doesn't do what they've committed to do, the contract is broken. A covenant is more than an agreement. It's a bond between people, one which is instituted by God and which is held by God, and which is a 100% commitment both directions. If one side doesn't meet their commitments, the bond is not necessarily broken. You know, if you have any familiarity, you know, through, you know, study of history, through the study of, you know, Westerns, whatever it might be, with the custom of blood brothers. It's been practiced, you know, in various places in human history. You know, the idea of nicking the wrists and putting them together so that my blood now flows in your veins and your blood flows in mine. You know, that two people becoming, in a sense, one, the same blood between them. And so You know, to care for myself requires that I care for you because there's some of me there. Yeah, which then, of course, you know, echoes the language of God in creating the institution of marriage, which biblically is also a covenant, though our society has, you know, little sense of that now. But it's very much this sense of almost a unitary commitment, that to give up on you is to give up on myself. And to underscore the seriousness of that commitment, covenant ceremonies in the ancient Near East were accompanied routinely by the sort of gruesome stuff that we see in Genesis 15. Yeah, I mean, cutting the animals in half and, you know, laying them out, you know, in a double row, creating an aisle, and then the dead birds. I mean, the meaning of this is not subtle. You pass between the pieces, you are saying, you know, by your own actions, may this be done to me if I let you down. If I fail to keep my promise to you, may I be cut in half. Which is why the oldest Hebrew phrase is not to make a covenant, but to cut a covenant. And did you catch the fact that only God passes between the pieces? That's not usually how it would be done. I mean, both parties would do that, but no, only God does. This is a unilateral promise. He's not requiring anything of Abram here. And in a sense, it's kind of weird that he does that because he's God. I mean, he's not going to break his promise. And if he did, it's not like anybody could do anything about it anyway. But for all that, he does. He passes between the pieces so that Abram will understand how serious he is about this. That, as we might say, God is serious as a heart attack about what he is promising to do for Abram. And part of the reason that it's so important for us to be able to wrap our minds around this understanding of covenant, you know, is that this is really the through line through all the scriptures. I mean, the Bible talks, you know, in some places about God's covenant with heaven and earth on the day of his creation. And he makes covenants with people at multiple points along the way. I mean, you know, if you happen to have, you know, physical Bibles open, you can flip back a few chapters to Genesis 9. You know, to the end of the story of Noah, where God makes a covenant with Noah that he will never again send a flood to wipe out life on the earth. And it's an interesting thing. And we see in Genesis 15, you know, there's this, you know, physical declaration of God that, you know, he's rendering himself liable to vengeance, you know, if he does not keep his word. Did you know that that's also in Genesis 9 in the covenant with Noah? He does the same thing there. We miss that because we see him say, you know, say that the rainbow will be the symbol of the covenant. We think, okay, you know, it's pretty. It's connected with rain. That makes sense. You know, it's something that we can see. It's a constant reminder. And it's just, I mean, you know, rainbows, I mean, they're like unicorns. It's just positive, sort of floofy, happy thing. But God doesn't say, I've set my rainbow in the clouds. He says, I've set my bow in the clouds. And that's a whole different thing. That's a whole different thing. Because the bow was one of the great weapons of warfare. And a drawn bow was a symbol of hostility. For the cultures of the Near East, seeing a drawn bow symbolized in any way in the heavens would have been a sign that the gods were angry. And that either the gods were going to make war on them or that they were being commanded to make war on someone else. But God has hung his bow in the clouds, pointing up. In the flood, he aimed his wrath at the earth. in the rainbow, he is re-aiming it, pointing it away from the earth. Aiming it at himself. There's all kinds of levels to this one. I mean, as they would have taken it, sign that it was a sign of his peace, because again, if he ever broke that, this was what he was invoking, aimed at himself. And then, of course, foreshadowing the fact that ultimately taking his wrath on himself was exactly what he was going to do. So God makes a covenant with Noah. He makes a covenant with Abram in Genesis 15. Then he does it again in Genesis 17, renaming him and adding a circumcision, which, I mean, I'll be honest, I don't know why he sort of splits that in half like that. It's very strange to me, but he does. Then in Exodus, he makes a covenant with all of Abraham's descendants together, with the Passover as the sign, you know, and with the law as the commitment that he asks from them for their part in it. He makes a covenant later on with David, promising that he will never remove David's descendants from the throne of Israel. Not supplant them anyway. I mean, obviously there is not a descendant of David sitting on a throne in Jerusalem at the moment. They remain in exile. It's still rightly theirs. And then ultimately in the true and full fulfillment of that promise to David, he sends great David's greater son, the Messiah, to bring his covenant with his people to its full completion and its full fruition, with baptism and circumcision replacing circumcision and the Passover. Excuse me, baptism and communion. My apologies, that's bad. Baptism and communion replacing circumcision and the Passover as the signs and seals of God's covenant with his people. The story of God's relationship with his people, with Israel, with us, is never primarily about what we do, and it is never dependent on what we do. The heart of the story is God's unfolding promise and plan to deliver his people from the power of slavery to sin and to death. As Eugene Peterson put it in The Message, it's a God story, not an Abraham story. And this truth is captured in one of, well, I think probably my favorite biblical word, and one that I know we've talked about here a few times over the last number of years, the word chesed, which, pity the poor translator, gives him fits. You know, it gets rendered a lot of different ways. Loving kindness, steadfast love, mercy, loyalty, just a few examples. But chesed is the covenant love and faithfulness of God. It's his unyielding commitment to love and to remain faithful to his people, no matter how many times or how badly we blow it. It's the commitment that Sally Lloyd-Jones in the Jesus Storybook Bible has dubbed his never stopping, never giving up, unbreaking, always and forever love. That's the heart of covenant. It's the heart, in particular, of the covenants that God makes with us. And it's what we are called to in the covenants that we make with one another, most profoundly in marriage, as we are supposed to be, in a sense, images of God's love and faithfulness for us. So as we tell the story of God's deliverance of his people, which is where we're focusing through these 4 months, this trimester of the year. What do we learn from the story of his covenant with Abraham? I see two things this morning, and I'm sure there are more, but I see two. Both of them really quite simple. This is not, in the end, a particularly hard thing. One, that God's deliverance comes not by might nor by power, but by a person. And, you know, that's really easy to not see, because there are times when God does bring about deliverance of his people through acts of great power. The beginning of the Exodus, it's, you know, one miracle after another for the Israelites and one calamity after another for the Egyptians. You know, as we sang earlier, you know, God, you know, parts the waters that we can pass through and then drowns our fears in the sea behind us. But, you know, it's easy to get really impressed with those times, with those events. It's easy to get so fixated on the power. Partly, I think, wish fulfillment. We wish we could make stuff like that happen. That we miss God. We get so focused on what he's doing that we don't notice him. And his interactions with Abraham offer us a corrective. Because, yeah, God does the big flashy stuff sometimes. But that's simply a means to an end. It's just a purpose, or just a tool, really. It's not the purpose. That's not where you should focus, because that's not the heart of what he's on about. The heart of what he's doing is in and through ordinary people like Abraham, like Sarah, like you, like me, living the ordinary day by day. And when the time came for him to win the most extraordinary victory in the history of creation, to shatter the power of sin and death once and for all, he did it by becoming an ordinary person. He had no beauty that we should take a second look at him, says Isaiah. He was the son of a working man, general contractor, man in the building business, in a small town in Mountain Valley, something of a backwater, close enough to be able to profit from the building boom that was going on in other parts of Galilee. But just an ordinary working guy. Yeah. I mean, think of David Kaufman. That's the sort of guy that Joseph was. You know, of a builder and a teenage mother who probably never really completely escaped the scandal of suspicion of how it ever did it happen that she got pregnant in the first place. Ordinary family and not the most respectable. Ordinary town, not any place that people were flocking to. Doing ordinary work, just the sort of stuff you got to do to make life work, to keep a roof over your head and over other people's. Who then grew up and left home and never had another home again. A wanderer, a vagrant, a vagabond, someone dependent on the support of others, and particularly on the wealthy women that we know followed him around. You know, dragging along a motley crew of ex-revolutionaries and not-so-ex-fishermen and ex-seminary students and ex-tax collectors, for crying out loud. Yeah, wandering up and down with dirt and donkey dung on his feet, going from town to town, stirring up a ruckus, insulting the religious leaders, confounding and confusing people, and generally making a real nuisance of himself. Not anyone the world thought was important. Someone the world thought was annoying. This is who God chose to be. If you would see God working, do not look to the extraordinary. Not because he isn't there, but because there you'll probably see what you expect to see and miss him. If you would see him working, look to the ordinary, to the everyday and the mundane. And two, well, Tom pointed out last week that God's deliverance often doesn't look like what we expect. After all, the surgeon's scalpel is maybe a necessary experience, but not a fun one. And Abraham shows us that it doesn't come when we expect either. I mean, Abraham was 75 years old when God took him for a very long walk and promised to give him and his barren wife a son and grandchildren, and the preposterous promise that they were going to multiply and multiply and multiply to become a great nation on the earth. And Abraham said, okay, and he went. And for 24 years, God strung him along. For 24 years, he would go to God, and God would say, yeah, yeah, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I still remember. I'm still going to do this. And for 24 years, Abraham would say, okay, God, I believe you. And the scripture says that's why God considered him righteous. That's why his relationship with God was right. Because he kept believing God when God kept saying, yeah, I'll get there. I can't go 24 days at home before people start thinking I've completely forgotten. Or they go and they do it themselves or, yeah, whatever. 24 years. This is almost a quarter century. That he keeps hanging on to God, with God talking the talk and not backing it up. And finally, it got to the point, the man is 99. His wife is 90. Obviously, it's too late. This has gone on too long. It's waited too long. This is impossible. God coming through is impossible. It's just not gonna happen. And that is when God fulfills his promise. He waits until it's obviously impossible even for God to do it, and then he does it. Just to completely reinvent our ideas about what's even conceivable for God. He doesn't do what we expect, and he doesn't do it when we think he has to. He answers questions we didn't think we were asking. That's one of the reasons Jesus annoyed people so much. And his ideas of what we need deliverance from don't even seem to match up a lot of the time with what we think needs to happen. And even when they do, it never seems to happen on our schedule. As Rich Mullins once said, I don't know why he's like that. Sometimes it makes me mad. But as he went on to say, don't do it a fight with God because he always wins. He bloodies your nose, then he gives you a ride home on his bicycle. But the thing is, and I don't know. I don't know who needs to hear this in this room today. Maybe nobody does but me. I just know I'm preaching to myself. If you look around and the deliverance that you long for, whatever that might be, isn't coming, and it seems like it's too late for you, If it seems like there's nothing left to hope for, like the time has passed, like it just can't possibly happen, that doesn't mean God isn't coming. Just means you're not 99 yet. It doesn't mean that he's forgotten you. It doesn't mean that he has abandoned you. It doesn't mean that he's given up on you. It does not mean that he is punishing you. And it does not mean that it is actually too late, because as long as God lives, it is never too late. Because the one for whom you wait, the one for whom I wait, is the one who gives life to the dead and calls into existence things that have never existed. And he is faithful who promised. Let's pray.